Yeah, so I'm going to talk about my work that I did with in collaboration with Ben Van Delt. And it's essentially how to try to make precision cosmology, that is to measure cosmological parameters, for example, the equation of state of dark energy, using cosmic voids. So just a quick reminder for those of you that don't necessarily remember. So we have in the SDSS, for example, here like this, is a picture of the SDSS, so the galaxy survey, and we can see that there is a lot of structures, and there are clusters, there are filaments, and you have also empty areas like this. So here there's a lot of projections, so you see this thing. And these things are the cosmic voids that I'm going to talk about. So why voids are interesting? Well, most of the last structure have been used in essentially two ways. Either you look at the power spectrum of the fluctuations, or you use, for example, in cluster observations. So you count clusters and say, okay, because we have some kind of predictions for the numbers, and you can relate it to cosmology. Counting of clusters is relatively easy. You just pop them and that's it. Of course, looking at the shape of cluster, which is also interesting, is much more difficult because you destroy information on the cosmological scale. So this is much more difficult. On the other hand, if you look at voids, you could say, okay, maybe it's not so hard to count them. Of course, you see that there are empty areas, but it's kind of, I remember, there are all these empty areas, but it's kind of fuzzy. So you may see that there is one void here and one void here, but it's less clear so you can see that as one void or two voids or something like that. So counting is a little bit less trivial. That's the thing, though. It all depends. So in principle, if you say that you look at all randomness regions, they should percolate, actually, and form only one void, which is not really adequate for what you want to do. So the other question is whether you could use, if let's say that you identify voids, can we use their shapes? Because as clusters are complicated because you form essentially chaotic structures inside clusters, voids are relatively dynamically simple. It's only a flow that is escaping from one area. So the two problems are the following. So on the one side, you have voids, where it will depend on void definitions, what you actually imply by counting and shape. And you have some distortion by expansion that may be corrected for. And the dynamics is relatively easy to model. On the other side, you have cluster observations, which is in principle less dependent on definition. But it has really complicated dynamics and strong redshift distortion whenever you look at them. So that's why it's maybe interesting to look at voids, is because you leave that, but you gain some kind of niceness in terms of dynamics. So the thing that you have several definitions of voids. So I picked here, for example, two. There is at least three conceptual definition of voids. So the most obvious one is say, okay, let's say that you smooth your density field and look at the structure, and you see that actually there are empty areas and filled areas, and see, okay, well, you can say that voids are the places where you have empty things. And so that's what I've been essentially discussed by these first two people here. And they say that, okay, you can do what's called a watershed transform. So essentially, you take the lowest density in your density field and make a hole in it and pump water. And you fill the landscape, the density field, with water. So that's why it's called watershed transform. So it's exact opposite of what's happening outside. So it's raining, and so the rain is falling and forming river, and then everything is going to the ocean. So that's why it's called watershed. And doing this actually is a nice way of actually delimiting what are voids, because whenever you're filling the landscape, you have saddle points. So at first you have only one void, for example, and then you have a saddle point that forms that merges the two voids together and form only one. So you form some kind of hierarchy. Thierry Sousby, so he did a much mathematically involved analysis where he looks at actually at voids from the point of view of Morse theory. And you can build up a skeleton on top of it. And and a very precise definition of what is your topology of your density field.
This was which paper?
Thierry Sousby? Sousby, yeah. So yeah, I did the first paper on the skeleton and the recent paper 2011 on the Morse theory on the unstructured density field. So you're not it's not necessarily to work on a smooth density field, you can do it on a non-continuous field. So the other point of view is say, okay, let's say that voids are actually a thing that are dynamically well defined. It's just an expanding bunch of matter. And you say, okay, you have also two ways of looking at this. The first way is say, okay, well, look at the gravity field. The gravity field should be just repulsive locally in terms of compared to the background metric. And then you compute this and you identify actually unstable, but currently unstable regions. So here we actually love this idea in terms of the displacement field. So what is the, how it is unstable in terms of integrated displacement from high redshift to present time. So I'm going to present these two approach here, the two approach that we followed. Yep. No, you have to compute them. So you have to use a model to compute them, of course. Yeah, but I'm going to discuss this. So yeah, the outline of the presentation will be the following. So I will talk about voids as cosmic stopwatches. So I will explain why stopwatches. Voids as tracers and other dynamics. And here is a cryptic picture that I will show later on. So void as cosmic stopwatches. So if you look at voids, actually you're tempted to do what's called a Nalcock-Pachinsky test. So the AP test is a relatively simple idea that if you have a physical structure which you know their physical size and look at it in terms of redshift, so actually on the Lycon, if you compare the two shapes, then it should be related by this ratio, which is essentially the angular distance divided by the redshift, and the Hubble expansion, the local Hubble expansion. And it has some cosmological dependence here, and it's slightly weaker here. And can we do this with void? Because voids are naturally, in principle, spherical. Well, if you look at voids in a simulation, so here I try to highlight a few voids of an n-body simulation. You see that it's kind of messy. You have all kind of different sizes, you have all kind of different shapes, and there is no clear physical scale, so doing an epitest directly is going to be a little bit difficult. On the other hand, if you start stacking voids of a given size, you say, okay, let's take a bunch of voids, even if they are completely ellipticals or strange shapes, because of the isotropy of large-scale structure, it should average out to something that is spherical. So even though all the voids are really messy, the envelope should be spherical, circular in that case, or spherical for voids. So we have our AP test. So how does it work really to do this? Because of course you have to have a stable algorithm that is able to identify these voids and have to identify voids that are share some kind of common approximate same volume. So the idea is the following. So you can start with your density tracers, so either galaxies or particles. So here is, for example, an n-body simulation. You put them in this hybrid coordinate system where you have actually the redshift in one direction, and the angular the angular distance on the orthogonal direction. And you extract a parabolic volume as really naively without any correction. And you map it this onto a cube. And then you run what's called Zobov. So Zobov has been developed by Mark Nehring. It's a watershed transform on an unstructured grid, essentially, where you run identify the basins. So if you have locally underdensed regions, it identifies all local minimum. And what are the saddle points between two voids? So in that case, you can identify a void hierarchy, so you can put all the voids into a tree. So you start with a smaller one, and you assemble them in to larger basins, and it gives you greater void up to the complete volume of your universe, essentially, that is considered as a void. Once you have this tree that you build up from bottom to top, you actually walk it down from the top. Because what you want is separated physically separated volume, such that if you pile them together, you don't add up coherently two structures that are the same, essentially. So you want to start from the bottom, and whenever you're meeting your a constraint, so in terms of volume, for example, say that you want to look at voids that are typically 8 megaparsec radius, and you want to look at actual under-dense regions, so you want to look at to impose the density constraints on this, then you can identify physically physically separated voids. So, for example, that's what happens if you walk down the tree. So here are the it's nearly the top of the tree, so you have only the largest thing. Then you start walking down the tree, and you see what's what are the sounds of all the the void sounds in your tree in a particular slice. So some of them may disappear because they actually belong to a slice that is slightly outside. So but the thing is that you populate, you see that the voids are becoming smaller, and they essentially populate the larger voids. Yes. Well, clusters as cluster essentially you can only do counting, and counting is limited essentially by the press sector,
because
which and the current even the best estimate may be only 10% for the prediction between press sector and the actual what you actually get in n-body simulations. And you cannot really do shapes because you destroy all the information, the shapes, so you lose all the information on the, for example, that is stored in the shear of the gravitational field. And
so it's just the voids are kind of less processed, less nonlinear.
Yeah.
Easier to, yeah.
Yeah. And here it's the first thing is because you can also do an AP test on it. So yeah, just because this algorithm originally works on a cube, so you want to so this is map on the cube, but of course you're not necessarily to map it exactly to a cube. You want to map it to something that is essentially isotropic, such that whenever you're going to make the whenever you're going to make a measurement, the actually what you see is the distortion. Well, you have the multiplication of the distortion that you have of because you put it on the cube times the cosmological expansion. Yeah. So the thing that we may worry about is whether you still see voids even they are strongly distorted. And the good thing is that the topology helps us really a lot, and actually it's very very strong even to use deformation. You can deform the matrix really. I mean, by factor of 3 or 4, and you still see most of your voids. At some point, it will break, but it's really tough. Yeah. So the one last thing before you're doing your stacking is to be really careful, because if you you want to find the centers of your void, because you want to look at the isotropic structure, and if you do the mass weighing by centers, then you will be biased by this structure, which means that you will actually lower your signal to noise because this structure will bug you in the stacking. So you want to do a volume weighing average, not a mass weight average. And it's an effect that you see in the stacking that appears here. And then you do an extraction of the spheres and centered on these barycenters. And you get this kind of thing when, here there is no cosmological expansion, just in n-body simulation, so to see what's happening. So you see that you have Here is the angular distance to the center of the void, of the stack void, and here is a redshift distance to the center of the stack void. So here there is no cosmological expansion, so everything is isotropic, and you see that it's quite smooth, and you even see the outer ring that is here, that is should be expected whenever you constrain to look at the minimum of the density field here. And then it goes back to homogeneity, and here is the limit of my extraction. So it's relatively smooth. So it's even actually too smooth compared to observations where galaxies are actually biased, and you should see more strongly this wall here. So actually here, for the purpose of this this presentation, I will use this kind of approximate model that it's relatively cubic here. But for galaxy, you should expect something that is a bit more strong. So actually, you will see more the walls. It is interesting because it means that if you're actually looking at this distortion, you will be more sensitive to the actual shape of your void. So what's happening whenever you put it, for example, at redshift 1? So here I put it in redshift 1, identified, stacked, and corrected for the purpose of representation here from the expansion. Well, it's clear that you still see the same overall structure for voids of, I think it's 8 megaparsec here. Now it's a bit smaller. It's about 6. So here there is no contamination by Peclo velocities. And here I introduce contamination by Peclo velocities. Because, of course, whenever you do observations, you have everything that is in all the effects that you can imagine. And the interesting thing is, okay, most of it is preserved, so you still see that the stacking looks stable, but you have actually a 16% effect here. So if you look precisely here, you have the yellow thing is going there. So so it means, and this 16% is actually expected whenever you do a modeling of spherical expansion, for example, and compare it to the local Lebesgue expansion of your void, then you measure approximately 16%. So this is not a crazy number, and this is actually a number that is also nice because it's not too dependent on cosmology. It's, if you try to change omega matter quite a bit, then it's going to be quite stable to 16. So it means that it's going to be maybe easy to correct for this number. Yeah? So the fluctuations are okay. There may be also structures inside your void. Even if it's a void, there are still galaxies or small groups that are inside. And this this is the fluctuation that you see here. And this is also the fluctuation that you see here that are the clusters that are just outside voids. So this is going to be an issue that I will show something that actually the structures are much more correlated than just the stacking, what would the stacking would imply. Means that all these things that you see, that it's relatively correlated on the large scale here on the stacking. And this is kind of a problem if you want to measure the shape. So for example, so here is how we modeled how we did for modeling the measurement of the shape of void. So we just picked a chi-square essentially. That we fitted the, so it will be more or less this density field, to a model that is cubic, essentially, where you introduce a distortion like this. And your model will be like, if you're inside your void, you'll be like a Poissonian distributed. And if you're outside, you just don't care what is the noise. So it's done to accept any kind of really large fluctuations that are outside the voids. So what it gives in practice is because of this really strong correlations that you have here, you want to minimize, and that you're not assuming here, you actually want to marginalize according to these really strong correlations. And the easiest way of doing it, even if you lose information in that case, is just to really pixelize heavily your stack density field. So that's what we did. So this is the effective density field that we use for doing the fitting. And here it's a picture of the Markov chain that we use for doing the fitting. And essentially, you don't see all these small fluctuations, but they still present the fact that you have, because you're doing a cylindrical averaging, you may have a small Poissonian error that is in this part here. So that's why you have to take a different error model. And on this side here, you may still have very large amplitude because just you have the ring that is outside that is still present, and you don't want to be sensitive to it. So in the end, whenever you do this measurement on NBD simulations and put it on LICON, you get this kind of thing. So at 6 megaparsec, you have, well, we measure there. So it's a free random regularization of the same cosmology. And you get this kind of fluctuations that are nicely on top of the theoretical expectation that is in black. And even if the error bars are relatively big, you see like the order of 10% or even 20. And here is for 14 megaparsec, so of course you have much less 14 megaparsec void, so you cannot do the same kind of slicing here in terms of redshift 0.1. But it's more like only really 6 slices. But you still see that they are more or less following the theoretical expectation, even if here there is an outlier. Second, so here there was no Peclore velocity field contamination in this test. If you do a Peclore velocity field contamination, you clearly see that there is this 16% effect that I already mentioned. And if you just say, okay, let's naively multiply by this 16% that you calibrated from simulations, then you see that, okay, well, it seems to go back to the expectation. Sorry? The stretching is just a ratio of the ellipse of the direction along the redshift direction and according to the angular direction. So this is the thing that I wrote at the beginning in the AP test. This is delta z or delta r, which is essentially a mix of the local Hubble constant with the angular distance. So this is what is used also for bionic acoustic oscillations experiments. So if you do Fisher matrix analysis, which is always kind of annoying because it's sort of very approximate and you have to do a lot of extrapolations, but still it gives an idea of what are the possibilities of this method. So with the SDSS, main galaxy sample, and if you try to look at voids and to try this game, then it would in principle give this kind of constraint here in blue. And the BAO should, with the BOSS experiment, should give the red one. So it's kind of same order of magnitude. Now, if you try this on Euclid, because Euclid has a much much higher sampling rate in terms of galaxies, and is much more deeper also, then actually just by statistical power of the number of voids that you have in your survey, then it reduces drastically all your error bars. So BAO is going to be limited by the 100 megaparsec scale, and so you have a fixed amount of 100 megaparsec ball that you can put in your survey. And for void, it's more like the scale of 10 megaparsec or so. So just because of this, you reduce your error bars. Of course, there is some kind of uncertainty of exactly what is this constraint, because it relies on extrapolation, as I say. But OK, you can expect to have a really, well, in principle, you should increase really a lot the constraint just using voids. So we are in the process of testing it with the SDSS and mock galaxy sample. So hopefully we'll have a better idea of what are the possibilities of this method. So this is the first part. You see that it's already interesting what you can do just doing this kind of analysis. But there is another aspect of voids that was the original motivation, that voids are more dynamically simple. And if you go back to this stacked idea, well, we use the average shape, but you have all this kind of ellipticity that you haven't used. So is it possible to actually look at them and see if we can extract information from it? Well, if you look at the velocity field, we see that the topology of the velocity field closely matches what is the topology of the density field. But the velocity field has the advantage of being simpler to model. And so if you look at here, you see that the shear of the elliptic of the velocity field looks like being linked to the ellipticity of your void here. So the advantage is that you can go to a local dynamical criterion, because if even if you're local in terms of velocity field, it's non-local in terms of density field. But also it means that we require to look at voids from another point of view. It's not, it's going to be another void finder. So what is this void finder? So you can say that, okay, you're looking at the dynamical criterion. So you say that void center actually here are going to be a source of displacement field, so the source of velocity field also nearly equivalently. And and this source actually corresponds to minima in the pyramidal density field, so they are like proto voids. And if you do, and if you look at how this proto void evolves, actually they form this kind of density field where you actually can identify an ellipticity here locally. So here I used, so I said that, well, is to start from initial condition and let it evolve you like this, but actually you only have the final product. So how do you relate the two? Well, we used what's called the method of reconstruction. So what's that? So I'm using what's called the Monge-Ampère Kantorowicz reconstruction method, which is based on the idea that if you can neglect all the shell crossings inside the collapse structures, then you can actually have a unique solution to your problems of evolution of structures. So let's say that you, yeah?
Did you already said how you're going to measure this flexible field?
No, I'm going to tell it near. So if you, let's say, okay, so everything that is inside cluster, you don't know really what's happening. It's really needs a lot of modeling. But if you say, okay, that you collapse your clusters to a point and say that everything inside doesn't matter, but your clusters in itself is non-shell crossed, then the displacement field of your cluster is actually non-shell crossed. And that means that it means that the displacement field is convex potential. So if you add to this mass conservation, then you end up with what's called the Monge-Ampère equation, which is just determinant of the Hessian of the change of coordinates between Lagrangian and Eulerian coordinates, which is related to the density contrast. And assuming that your initial density field is homogeneous, then you can relate this to this. So of course it's kind of complicated to directly solve this equation. So it's possible to do it on using fields, but using particles is a bit more complicated. But there is an equivalence that is said that this problem here has been shown to be like a Monge-Kantorowicz problem, which is an optimization problem where you actually just try to minimize the huge chi-square. So it's like a ballistic approach to the movement of particles. So for the story, it was a 200-year-old problem, so because it was enunciated by Monge and Ampère and solved in the 1980s by this guy, Yann Brenier. So of course, it's also numerically involved, so there is algorithms that exist that solve this in typically in the number of particles squared or cubed in terms of complexity. And but it's possible. So the idea is now, okay, let's say that you have your final distribution of galaxies, you apply this algorithm, and it's going to give you two things, the Lagrangian coordinates and the displacement field. So, okay, let's say that now you have the thing for measuring the displacement field. What is the statistics of the ellipticity? Well, yeah? It's unique if you look at non-shell cross regions, yeah. And you neglect the decaying mode.
You should have some constraint, extra constraint to fix this mapping function.
So the problem is mixed boundary. So you have one constraint in this, and the other constraint is what you observe now. Yeah, it's really this hypothesis is actually removing all the non-trivial solutions. Yeah, so for the statistics of it, so there is, so actually you look at the statistics of the eigenvalues of your shear of the gravitational field. And there is an old paper from Doroshkevich that's actually show how to do this on Gaussian random fields, given the actual variance of your Gaussian random field. And it gives you this and say, okay, well, now you can just write the ellipticity using the eigenvalues and predict the probability. Unfortunately, it's the problem with this approach is that it's unconditioned and you're looking actually at voids. And voids are minimum of the density field, which are unfortunately correlated with the curvature of your gravitational field, which means that this is not correct. And the correct approach is to actually condition your first Gaussian random field by the curvature it should be positive and look at the statistics of eigenvalues given that it's positive. The problem is that in that case, it's much more complicated analytically and you have to do it with the Monte Carlo approach. But the advantage is whenever you're measuring the ellipticity, so here's what happens if you apply Doroshkevich, and if you condition it, you get the right curve. So it changes really the statistics. And here's what happens if you look at the simulation and you see that all points are just falling on top of it and using the Mach reconstruction on the simulation, of course.
So the points are so close
to being described. I thought that maybe the points were, if they were sufficiently deep, they wouldn't be described as kind of fast. No, because they are really, they are nonlinear, but the mapping is linear. So the displacement field is still linear, even if the change of coordinates gives you something that is really nonlinear. So that works really nicely, actually. It works so nicely that if you plot the evolution of the mean ellipticity that you measure here, and with different redshift time, and look at the actual residuals, so you have one realization is here of the simulation, and here is another realization, and actually the main difference here between those two is the actual sigma that you have in your simulation. That is, the actual realization of it give you a slightly different sigma 8, and this is what you look at the residuals. And if you look at this one, you have like 0.1% residual. So this is maybe the only structure where you can measure something at nearly 0.1% of precision. So if you attend this for two different cosmology, for example, let's say that you pick a equation of state -1 for dark energy and -0.5, but normalized at the same sigma 8 at the end. So your ellipticity, mean ellipticity at the end is the same, it's normal. But then the evolution is different depending on your cosmology. And it's the error bars are here actually, that just because of the counting. And you see that it's very clear how to distinguish those two models. So, this thing here. So here it's just because you count the. It depends on how you count the ellipticity. Actually, it's because the. Where is it? Yeah, here in this definition of ellipticity, the lambda 1, lambda 3 are growing with the gross factor. And here there is a. You alleviate the degeneracy. So it's a way of measuring how the structures are growing in the displacement field. So of course there will be some in observations there will be some degeneracies because of course you're using galaxies, you still have the bias that lingers in. But you should be able to marginalize over it or use other assumption and try to measure this thing. It will be an independent test. So the other aspect is that you can also look at the volume of voids and to see if you can define some statistics of it also. Yeah? Yeah, so there's one collaborator that did that with a Fisher matrix analysis. It's just later, it's on the next slide. I'm going to show it at the end. So, just a parenthesis. I will show it after. So here is you can try also to define the volume of voids, because you may want to say, okay, you look at the at the beginning the idea was, okay, you had the voids and you want to look at their shape, and whether if the volume, the shape of the your void is linked to actually the ellipticity of the shear of the gravitational field. So it's just an idea to see if everything is consistent. And so you can define also volume. So as originally in the first method, you had some way of defining volume. So here is a way that is completely Lagrangian. So you look at, so here is the initial density field where you have small fluctuations and you have your protovoids here. And this is what is identified using the source of displacement field. And here is the attractor of displacement field, which are the proto clusters. So what you want is actually to consider voids that are actually under dense region. So you don't want to go beyond this limit. And you want also to avoid mixing two voids together, because they may form walls at the intersection. So you impose two constraints. That is, you have you don't want to go into the higher density regions, and you don't want to cross saddle points. So, and whenever you do this in 3D, it gives this cryptic picture. And so, if this is the n-body, this is the particles in the n-body simulation. So centered on the void, and here is the divergence. So the mean density surface, where you have zero density, well, zero fluctuations. So you see that the clusters are isolated here. And here is the whenever you impose a constraint that shouldn't cross saddle points. So you have actually, according to this criterion, multiple void inside. Okay. So if you look at the relation with the volume ellipticity, actually you should have you look at this. So this is the ellipticity according to the VLT field, and this is the ellipticity on volumes, and see that, as expected, it's correlated, but with a huge scatter, because one is a non-local measurement compared to the other one. So to first order, they are the same. I can compute it, but there is a large scatter. Okay, so yeah, to finish up with this. So this this is a Fisher matrix analysis that's been made by Harald Biswas, Svante Arizadeh, and Ben van Delt. So they considered the SDSS constraints from voids and different probes at the same time, and the one that should be derived from Euclid and the same probes, and say that voids may, in principle, add a nice contribution to the constraints. Okay, so yeah. Slightly fast, but here's the conclusion. So there are two, so I tried to present two approaches on voids. So you can look at voids from the point of view of the average shapes and doing an AP test, so you can derive some kind of Hubble diagram. And also from the point of view of the individual void shapes, and which are actually modeling the dynamics of the, on top of the expansion, and probe the growth factor of the of your large scale structures. And the interesting thing is actually they are complementary, because you can just start with your average shapes, measure your expansion, and then measure the actual distribution of shapes on top of the expansion. So they are like self-consistent. And so far we tested the AP test on basic mock catalogs, that is particles on Lycon. We are trying now to do it on the SDSS main galaxy sample. And this one we tested on N-body simulation with redshift distortion. You see that it's still the signal is still there. And what will be really nice in the future is to apply it to the 2M++. So 2M++ is my fancy catalog, so it's a full sky galaxy catalog on the local universe, and also to Euclid in future, but it will be really far away. So yeah, thank you very much. So 2M++ is a full sky survey of it's made of the SDSS, so the 6DF and the 2MassReach survey. So it's a full sky survey. It's selected using the photometry of 2Mass, so in K-band. And it's typically deep up to 200 megaparsec, but full sky.
And you constructed it?
Yeah. And so the advantage that you see really finely all the small voids, and you can really see the Shapley concentration embedded into the whole network. And so it's a very nice lab for testing large-scale structure on the local universe. I don't know if I have a movie of it. Let's see. Yeah. Not sure. Well, this one is not so good. Well, prefer the first one. So this is just an idea of what is actually the 2M++. So the scale of the box is roughly 300 megaparsec from one side to the other. And this is just to highlight the large scale structure, so the higher density concentration inside it. And all the points here are just galaxies, and we are the center. Yeah.
So, just a question, how observational you're going to find these voids, because they're somehow luministic? Limited,
yeah, so for this one, actually, you don't. It's not really sensitive to completeness. You want to be sure that the completeness is homogeneous in one redshift slice to avoid mixing several things. But for different redshift slices, you don't care if the completeness evolve. And of course, the more magnitude limited you are, the less small voids you're going to see, and more it will be mostly the large one where that are traced with just that are bound by the largest, brightest clusters. So here it's not necessarily that interesting, because you don't gain much compared to just a power spectrum analysis, for example, for as in BOSS. So you're more interested in the smaller ones. So actually it's interesting, because if you can nearly have the same power of just looking at with a high magnitude cutoff, and but just a small pencil beam for in terms of surveys, instead of doing a large scale sky survey and with a brighter magnitude limit. Because if you do brighter magnitude limit, actually you're losing all the small voids information, which are actually the most important for this, because you have a huge number of small voids.
Did you get some distribution of the voids as a function of their size, like the Schlichter function for the voids?
Yeah, so this is this is very complicated because all predictions that exist are actually based on a pressure sector kind of approach, which actually do not match any void finder. So anything that you're going to define, actually you should build up the analytical models that match what you're actually defining as a void. No, I don't have it here, but there is. We try to for modeling this for doing the Fisher matrix analysis modeling. We actually measured the abundance of voids in our different redshift slices. So for a given volume criterion, it was not really evolving. So yeah, whatever it's happening between 0 and 1 is not really touching our observations. So that's kind of funny because most of the voids are actually dependent actually on formation large scale structure. You see expect that they evolve, but actually how you define it, they don't really evolve much. The other thing is for the void defining using the dynamical criterion like here. Actually you shouldn't do press sector. You should use the good old Berlin bond. It's a BBKS, so the Berlin bond, the Kaiser-Zalle paper, where they actually count the number of peaks in Gaussian random fields, and actually it matches the number of peaks that you have, the number of voids that you have. More or less, you have a small discrepancy that is actually linked to the. It's also funny. You have to think in the opposite way whenever you do this, because voids are actually destroyed whenever structures forms. You actually, it's only a decreasing function. So whenever you're going to measure the number of voids, you actually want to measure the number of destruction of voids when you look back in time. Compared to the BBAKS formula, you're going to see a number that is lower. And whenever you go to higher redshift, well, in terms of time, you will see a number of voids that should match much better the formula. Okay.